Today we're speaking with David Perlett from Vinson & Company. Vinson & Company is an extremely knowledgeable firm composed of experts in courtroom persuasion and jury selection models. Hello, Mr. Perlett.
Good morning.
Good morning. So before jumping in, can you please tell us about what you do and what makes Vinson & Company different than other trial consultancy firms?
Sure. So what we do is we work with lawyers and law firms to help them understand, as they're preparing for trial, how jurors are likely to look at the facts and the evidence in their case, how they're likely to react to the arguments and the advocacy that they're going to be presenting at trial. And how jurors ultimately make decisions, particularly in situations of uncertainty. And what I mean by that is most of the time we're retained by counsel, usually in high stakes, high profile, but most importantly, complex litigation, where the facts and the evidence are very complicated, and that the outcome is in question. And they really need to know, how do lay people, essentially, people from all walks of life, how are they likely to come into a case with these kinds of complex fact patterns and make decisions about things that they don't really have a lot of experience about in their everyday lives? What sort of factors are going to play roles in their decision making? Will biases or prejudices seep in, and in what ways, what shapes or forms, and how can they structure their arguments and their presentations to address those variables? So that's predominantly what we do.
Wow, that is so important. I'm so glad you brought that up, because something that's always confounded me about the jury process is the way that lay people are assigned to make decisions about very complicated specific fields of science a lot of times. You know, if a jury is composed and supposed to be deciding on some really complicated medical testimony when none of them have any medical expertise, that's always been a confusing aspect of the jury process for me to wrap my brain around. And so that's something that you really dial into in your line of work.
Yes, because it's incumbent upon trial counsel to not only advocate for their client, but oftentimes try to take these complex concepts and make them understandable so that a jury can make good decisions. And if they're in situations where they don't understand what's happening or they don't understand what the testimony is, then what tends to happen is jurors fill in the gaps in their knowledge with what we would call factoids. And what that means is they will draw from their own experiences, their own common sense, and try to fill in those gaps or fill in that understanding so that they feel more confident in the decisions that they make. And oftentimes, those factoids don't have much basis in reality, but it's not because jurors are ignorant. It's because they're trying to do their best in, under circumstances in which they don't have a lot of background information, which they don't have a lot of understanding. And so if counsel doesn't help them in that regard, then they'll try to figure out ways to figure out what the appropriate decision should be.
Right. I've tried putting myself in the position of a juror on many occasions and imagining how I would form decisions. And I think that it's practically impossible not to draw upon any personal experience, even though we would be specifically directed not to do that. That's just the way that we as humans tend to form decisions.
Right. And it's very difficult because jurors are being told, on the one hand, not to bring their own personal experiences in to evaluate a case, but they're also being instructed to use their common sense. So those are almost two sort of contradictory concepts, which is, well, how does one use their common sense without relying upon past experiences?
That is such
it's a difficult
an
proposition.
Excellent observation. I never really thought about that, but you're so right. Those are contradictory instructions, basically. And speaking of directions that jurors are given, while I was researching your company, Vinson & Company, I found this really incredibly interesting article on your site. It was titled Devil on the Jury, and it listed a lot of common problems with the jury process. So I would love to direct my listeners to check it out by going to bit.ly/devilonthejury, all lowercase. The first thing this paper talks about is the likelihood of jurors to abide by the rules of refraining from internet searches. I was surprised by how many people admitted to not following this direction. I think it was 11%, and those are just the people that admitted to the fact that they wouldn't abide by that instruction. So I'm curious, what are your thoughts on how strictly juries adhere to all of the directions they're given?
So let me give a little bit of background about that paper. So what was sort of prompted the paper was the idea that, well, jurors are given these instructions about what they should and what they shouldn't do in any given case. And those instructions are pretty standard across all types of cases, whether they be criminal cases or civil cases, not to do outside research, not to discuss the matter at hand with their fellow jurors until all the facts and the evidence have been presented. But we really don't know, right? I mean, how strictly do jurors abide by that? So we put together a survey, and the survey and the paper were written by two of my colleagues. And the idea was to try to get some kind of a grasp or some sort of idea or some sort of estimate as to how much do jurors adhere to those instructions. And you're quite right. When jurors were asked, or excuse me, when our survey participants, who are all jury-eligible individuals, were asked about what they would likely do, about 10%, just a little bit more than 10%, admitted that they wouldn't be able to follow those instructions, that they would do their own outside research. And that's a bit of a high number, but we also know that when people are asked about behaviors that are not socially acceptable or that are, in this instance, prohibited, they may not be as forthcoming in terms of admitting what they would actually do in those circumstances. So
right.
In the research, my colleagues took a really unique approach to investigating this issue, which is to not only ask the question directly, but then to ask some of the survey participants what they thought others would do in those circumstances. And this sort of indirect line of questioning has a pretty significant history in different forms of psychological research. The underlying theory behind it being that, you know, oftentimes when talking about, again, socially undesirable actions or behaviors that would be prohibited, people may not want willingly admit to engaging in them, but they may very well project those tendencies when asked about how others might behave in those situations. And when we ask those questions, a much higher proportion of our survey respondents thought that others would not abide by a judge's instructions not to do outside research. And I think the numbers were somewhere around 40 or 50%, right?
Yes.
So does that mean that there's, out of 12 potential jurors in a case, that one of them is doing outside research? Does it mean six are doing outside research? That's a pretty wide range there, right? But I think what it points to is that it is likely that jurors may try to do some outside research on a given case, particularly if it's one that's high profile or that's going to be in the media, or which they know that they can hop online and probably find some information about. So it's certainly an issue, especially in this day and age when accessing information through the internet is so easy.
Absolutely. And a friend of mine and a highly competent defense attorney, Jessa Nicholson Getz, I know that she feels very passionately about the way the media depicts her clients and how it tends to be sort of biased against the defendant. And I think that she would be really frustrated at hearing these statistics about how often juries are probably conducting their own outside research just through, you know, Google searches or whatever might pop up on Facebook. I mean, there are so many ways to seek out information in this day and age.
Right. It's certainly a sobering thought. And again, you know, the paper is not definitive on this, but I think it provides a lot of food for thought for counsel in terms of understanding, or at least being aware of, what may be happening, you know, outside the courtroom.
Right. Another topic addressed in this paper wasn't only, what's the likelihood of you to conduct outside research via the internet, for example, but how likely you were to discuss the case with other people in your life. And I have to admit, and I, again, shamefully, I'm admitting this, but when really pressed, I think that if I were on a jury and I was going home every night, I would feel, I would want to discuss that case with my spouse, feeling that like that was within the confines, the security of it not going any farther than that, which is itself breaking the law, breaking an instruction. And I think a lot of jurors would probably suffer from those same inclinations.
Well, it's a really unique circumstance, right? I mean, I can't think of anything else off the top of my head, any other kind of circumstance in which you find yourself in a situation where you're, going to this activity every day for however long it may be. Maybe it's a couple days, maybe it's a couple weeks. And hearing all this information and then not being able to talk about it with anybody, not with your fellow jurors. You're being instructed not to talk about it with your spouse or your significant other, your close friends. It's a really unique situation to be put in. Although I do think that jurors try very, very hard to not violate the court's instructions. But again, it is a unique situation, and sometimes they may find themselves slipping, if you will.
Right, absolutely. I mean, if you take sequester juries, for example, I know that they're not supposed to discuss the case with one another while the trial is ongoing. They're only supposed to discuss it once deliberations have begun. But one of the problems with sequester juries that I've discovered in my research is that it tends to lead to groupthink, meaning everyone kind of comes to a mutual consensus over the course of the trial in these close quarters, which sort of suggests they're already discussing it with one another or at least communicating in some fashion, and they reach a decision before closing arguments have even started. And so, I think that need to discuss especially heavy subject material with one another is a very natural thing and must be very difficult to fight.
I think it is natural, but again, I will say that I do think that many jurors try very, very hard to follow court's instructions. And we've talked with, there have been instances where we've had an opportunity to speak with jurors after trials have concluded about what their experiences were and what they took away from the trial and what the process was like. And oftentimes what we found is that, particularly when they're engaged in these lengthy trials, and they're trying really hard to abide by the court's instructions, what they wind up doing as a group is finding what I'll call, for lack of a better term, sort of safe topics to talk about. That helps them avoid discussing the case. And I think what's interesting about that is that what it points to is the need to sort of be actively on guard, right? In those instances where jurors have told us these are the things that they do to avoid talking about the case, it becomes abundantly clear that they are not only aware of what the court's instructions have been, but are actively engaged in trying to follow those instructions. And in doing so, they wind up finding, again, sort of safe topics to talk about. It could be personal life experiences. It could be, other topics of the day. But they try very actively to avoid getting into talking about the case.
Well, that's positive. Good for that. That really speaks to the character and integrity of most jurors. So I love hearing that. Have you noticed, can unhealthy dynamics or relationships develop between jurors? And if so, how does that impact their decision making?
Yes, it certainly can happen. A group of jurors is no different than any other group of people in society, right? Not everyone is always going to get along. There can be personality differences. There can be group dynamics that wind up playing a role in what the deliberation process looks like. As an example, we had a case some years back where there was a distinct difference within the jury among the juror members in terms of their socioeconomic backgrounds. And Wenger was the outlier in terms of, again, socioeconomic background with the other jurors. And what we found out later, after the case had been decided, was that it became a very cliquish sort of group in which this one juror had essentially been excluded. And over the course of the deliberations, which took several days, this juror became not only more and more isolated, but wound up feeling more and more intimidated by the group, to the point where she finally acceded to how the rest of the group was thinking and rendered a verdict that was in line with the majority of the other jurors. Although in her heart of hearts, she didn't really feel that that was the appropriate verdict to render, but she had just essentially been worn down.
Wow. That speaks to an unhealthy dynamic that's negative. Have you ever encountered jurors that develop romantic attachments or unhealthy positive dynamics?
I don't know of any instance, at least that I'm aware of jurors developing romantic interests in one another, although it's entirely possible that it's happened. But certainly there are, we've also seen the opposite. We've seen very positive interactions among jurors where they are, I mentioned earlier about how we've spoken with jurors after cases have been tried in instances where we've been able to and found out that they've, you know, they've found common ground or safe topics to talk about. And they wind up spending time together after the trial. Some become friends. Some decide to meet for lunch a week later to just sort of revisit, you know, what they went through together. You know, you don't do that if you had a bad experience with your fellow jurors. So, you know, the dynamics can go either way for any of a variety of reasons.
Right.
Again, personality factors. Leadership style among the group members, all sorts of factors can come into play in that regard.
That makes sense. Given your extensive amount of research on jury behavior, have you made any observations that you think would just surprise the public about juries or jury behavior?
You know, I think what might surprise the public is to hear that, and I sort of alluded to this before, is that jurors try really hard to get it right. And I'll give you sort of two examples of what I'm thinking of. One goes back to the research paper that our firm did fairly recently about, you know, do jurors follow the instructions and do they abide by what they're told by the judge in terms of not doing outside research? You know, when we hear that jurors are willing to violate that order, we're skipping over something critically important, which is, well, what's their motivation for doing so? Are they just doing so out of spite because they don't want to be told what to do, because they don't care about the court's instructions? And I would argue that it's typically not that reason. I would argue that in those instances where jurors feel compelled to, for example, do outside research, it's because they're trying to get to the right answer. And because there is some information that they didn't understand or that they felt was important that they didn't hear about, and they think they need that in order to render a fair decision.
Wow.
As an example, we had a case a few years ago where the court was abundantly clear about not doing any outside research. In the course of deliberations, there was a term, an issue that jurors weren't sure how it should be defined, and they couldn't find any clarity in the instructions. One of the jurors came in to the deliberations one day with a dictionary to define the term for the group. They used a Webster's dictionary to provide the definition. That was not something that the court had approved doing. The individual who did that was a retired school principal. This was not an individual who had an agenda or an axe to grind or a particular outcome that he was trying to get to. He was simply trying to help the group come to a consensus on what a particular term meant so that they could then go on and continue their deliberations.
Right, and that seems like a pretty innocuous way of defining, rather than going online or getting on your smartphone to do it. I think like finding a dictionary would seem safe to a lot of people. Were there ramifications when that happened?
I don't think there were ramifications. I think it was determined later that it was sort of an innocuous event. But nonetheless, it was one that still was a violation of what the court had instructed. And in spite of very clear, instructions that no outside information should be brought in, no outside research should be done, it didn't occur to this individual that that was considered outside research.
Right.
Example I would bring up in terms of what I think the public might be surprised about is, I think there is a widespread belief that juries often make outrageous decisions, particularly in civil cases, particularly with regard to damage awards against corporations. And I think we see all the time in newspapers and news reports about juries making, hundreds of millions of dollars of decisions and awards. Maybe it's to an individual, maybe it's to another company. And there's a sense that jury verdicts are just out of control. And I do think there is some support for that. And I do think there are instances in which juries can sort of go off the rails, if you will. But I think what the public doesn't realize is that a lot of times the jurors themselves feel that they have a very solid basis for the decisions they render. And it's easy to see a headline and to just sort of write it off as, bunch of crazy people making an outlandish decision. When in reality, I think it's much more nuanced and complicated than that. I mean, oftentimes we're talking about people who have sat and listened to an awful lot of evidence over a very lengthy amount of time, and are basing their decisions on information that the public doesn't know and hasn't been paying attention to. And so when we see those kinds of awards or those kinds of results happen, I think rather than have that knee-jerk reaction to think that this was just a silly decision that people made, it's really important to understand that, people, particularly in groups of 6, 10, 12 individuals, aren't always just making poor decisions, right? There's a reason. There's a basis upon which they've made that decision. And they did it collectively. And so it's really important to understand, and this is part of what our job is in those instances, what were the factors that went into this? How were jurors thinking about the case? What was the framework in which they were considering the facts and the evidence that led to the decisions that they rendered? So I think it's a much more complicated story than just saying that people make bad decisions at times.
Right. You seem to have a lot of respect for jurors. I like that.
Well, I do.
Yeah, clearly you do. You speak about them, not reverentially, but certainly like with a great deal of respect. And you're consistently noting like their integrity and their honor and their willingness to like see justice done. And I think that's a beautiful quality, especially for someone who studies them for a living. I think that I just wanted to call that out, that I'm struck by that in you.
Oh well, I appreciate that. I think it's a sort of a necessary trait. I mean, if you look at people, particularly in my line of work, and make knee-jerk reactions about them or just attribute what they do or how they behave to, superficial qualities, then you're not really doing a very good job of understanding the motivations behind their decisions. You're never really going to understand how or why people make decisions. And if I don't understand that, then I can't help my clients figure it out either.
Right. Do you think, and this is, we're just having such a positive note. I don't want to take it to a negative place, but maybe your answer won't be negative. I did want to ask you before we reach the end of this interview, whether or not you believe that the American jury system is broken. Do you think it is?
No, I don't. I don't think it's broken. I think, though, that, you know, any system that you put in place that's going to be populated by individuals, it's by necessity is not going to be perfect. Do people make mistakes? Sure, of course they do. Is every jury verdict the appropriate verdict? Probably not. But, you know, the system is not just centered around juries, right? There's an entire ecosystem around the jury process so that there are means to correct problems that occur or mistakes that happen, right? So jurors are granted an enormous responsibility, but then there are also appeals courts and other things that surround that that serve as checks and balances, if you will. It's not a perfect system, but I think it's a long way from being broken.
Are there any flaws in particular that you wish would be addressed when it comes to legislature or just the jury system in general?
So, you know, one issue that pops to mind is, and I've alluded to this a couple times, you know, many of the cases that we get involved in are complex matters that are not, you know, tried in a day or 2 days. They can take a couple weeks. Some have even lasted a couple months. And so what does that mean in terms of who can actually serve on a jury like that, right? And so you oftentimes wind up with a prospective jury pool that's quite different from the overall population. And it can be quite different in two different regards, right? On the one hand, you may have people in professional occupations, right, who simply can't afford to be away from work for that long. You can also have people on the other end of the spectrum who might not be in professional careers, who may, you know, be working part-time jobs, if you will, multiple part-time jobs to make ends meet. Those people as well can't take the time off. They won't be paid. They have a financial hardship. They won't be able to pay their bills. So they wind up being excluded, self-excluding themselves, but for understandable reasons, right? And so that aspect of, I think, the jury system probably does serve to kind of skew in different ways, you know, the shape of the actual jury pool, such that it may not be entirely representative of whatever venue you are in. And there may be entire classes of individuals, entire professions of individuals who aren't able or who don't wind up serving for a variety of reasons. And it's not just in one direction. It can be, you know, it can affect multiple layers of society in terms of their participation in the jury system. And so that's one thing that I think we need to be considerate about is what our jury pools look like and what our actual juries look like. Are they, how representative are they of our overall society?
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent point. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to educate us today, David. I just want my listeners to give them that URL again. If you do want to check out this paper, it's really great. bit.ly/devilonthejury. Check it out if you're interested in learning more about this survey that they conducted. David, if people want to learn more about you or about Vincent & Company, how can they do that?
The best way would be to take a look at our website, which is just very simply www.vinsoncompany.com.
VinsonCompany.com, yes?
That's correct.
Okay, excellent. Thanks again, David, and this was a tremendous interview. I'm really grateful for your perspective, and maybe one day we can chat again.
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Thanks for listening. Next week, we are exploring the romantic history of Ava Michaels as well as her history of suicide attempts. See you then.